Welcome to On Delmarva, and I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Every week, you'll find us right here on WEAA as we follow the stories that affect the land and the communities of Delmarva. This week, join us for a tour of the Chop Tank Oyster Company, an oyster farm that produces the Chop Tank Suite for restaurants and grocery stores throughout the Mid-Atlantic. First, let's get you home safe with WEAA traffic, and then we'll be right back with Kevin McLaren of the Chop Tank Sweet Oyster Company. Welcome to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. This week, join us for a tour of the Chop Tank Oyster Company. We started the day with farm manager Kevin McLaren, who took us out onto his dock on the Chop Tank River. As we stood looking out at the millions of oysters growing on floats in the river, I asked him how he found himself in the oyster farming business.
I went to college for marine science. I grew up in the city. I grew up in Philadelphia, so I figured I got to get away from the city. So how do you get away? You do something that you can't do in the city. You know what I mean? So my first job was up in New England. I went to a place in western Massachusetts, and I was growing fish in tanks in an industrial park in New England, which was fine. A good place to cut your teeth. You learned a lot.
Yeah, what were you growing?
Hybrid striped bass. Uh-huh. And that was back during the moratorium here. So there was good money in hybrid striped bass. You know, the thing about fin fish is everybody's chasing the next fish, right? So as a fish becomes popular, you can make a ton of money on it until everybody else jumps into the game and the prices start to plummet. So we were growing those up there when it wasn't very popular to grow them, but they were becoming popular to eat. So there was some money, but then all of a sudden everybody else jumps into the game. They produce everything really cheap, and then you know, you got to move on to the next fish. And fish aquaculture is tough. You know, that's a tough nut to make. So shellfish is a lot easier.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't require. I mean, our electric bill there was $30,000 a month. Yeah,
in the fish
business. Yeah, I don't pay that in 3 years here. I mean, because we really have very little pumping. The only time we pump anything or run lights is in a hatchery, and that only operates for about 3 months a year. And we're started now. We're up and running, and hopefully we're out of the hatchery by May. So what we do is we get in there, produce our crop of seed oysters that we need and what we're going to sell, and then that's it. We shut everything down, and then everything is out here. So there's no power involved at all. There's no feed costs. There's nothing. You know, it's more like ranching than it is like farming, because you're essentially just putting your animals out to pasture. And you take care of them. You steward over them, but you don't feed them. You don't really. There's not really much you do with them.
Now, how long have you been doing this? 3 years? 4 years?
No, I've been. I came down to start this company in '99. So we've been selling for probably, I guess, close to 5 years. So it's a real long lead-up time to kind of get into the business. And you know, you got to get animals in the water. So you're even looking to 3 years down the line before you can even sell your first animals.
It's pretty capital intensive.
It's not compared to building a factory and manufacturing something. Because there aren't those upfront costs, but what you do is you have some labor costs that are involved before you start to have a product to sell. Do you know what I mean? So really, it's not capital intensive in terms of materials, but just in terms of people. But we ran real lean. You know, it was just myself down here for the longest time, you know, just getting stuff. And we didn't start adding personnel until we needed to, which is when we started to sell. We started to have, you know, more oysters than could easily be handled by one to two people. So then we start. And, you know, right now we're running with four people. So we're operating a farm that has 8 million oysters in the water at any given time with four people.
How many oysters are you now?
Right now we're probably looking, we're about on the 6 million side right now.
Not a lot of space for 6 million oysters. I mean, I would imagine when you think about 6 million, that's a huge number.
But you also have to understand that part of that population of 6 million are only this big. So that many oysters. You fit a lot of oysters in a very small area. I've got 2 million oysters in about one quarter of that section right there. So there's, you know, because they're smaller, you can pack them into a smaller place. And it's as they get larger is that they start to take up more and more real estate. And that's as you're selling them. So as they're becoming larger, you're harvesting them, boxing them, and selling them. So there's always kind of a breathing to the farm almost. You know, you always swell a little bit, and then you shrink.
You read about and talk about they don't buy harvested oysters. More people are buying these oysters.
I think, yeah, no, I think they should, you know.
Like with the business.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in all, you know, they really should. And I think, you know, one of the things that we were pushing to get into was Whole Foods. You know, for a while, now I'm in every Whole Foods in the whole Mid-Atlantic area, from Princeton, New Jersey, down to, like, North Carolina, out to Ohio. And, you know, I went to those guys and said, hey, you know, this product is for you. You can't sell harvested oysters. I said, you know, they're a small vestige of what they used to be. What are you doing? You got to buy my oysters. You know, and now they do. Now they buy my oysters.
Well, what about that? I mean, I'm curious about this. I'm going to get into the history of this industry, and you're in it, and what you do here, but and how this works. But the argument between the different what oysters to use and what not to use. I mean, there's a diminishing supply of oysters. They're trying to rebuild it. I'm curious, so what the oysters were when they were in their heyday, obviously. They cleaned the bay, they cleaned the rivers, they were a natural filtration system. But what you're doing here has nothing to do with that. This is, right? I mean,
we're doing this to make money, but it's providing the same service as wild oysters. You know, our oysters are constantly filtering the water and cleaning it. And what they do is they pull out microalgae, which is plants. They're single cell plants that float around in the water. That's what makes the water green. You look at that water, you know, people go, oh, it's that water's so green, it's dirty. I look at that water and I say, that's a smorgasbord of food. I mean, I could take a drop of that and let you look at it under the microscope, and it is full of food. You know, and what my oysters do is they filter that food out. So in one side comes algae-laden water. Out the other side of that oyster comes cleaner water. And they, because they just, you know, they're stripping everything out, and then they're converting that to shell and to meat, which then we harvest and people eat.
So the what about the? Some people said, well, somebody said this morning, well, what about the whatever you call it, an oyster, which I've just forgotten, the fecal matter of an oyster, and that dripping to the bottom of the river.
That actually becomes a food source. I've watched fish pick at it as it's coming off, because it's like if you ever been into a dairy barn, and it may not sound very appealing, but dogs eat cow poop because there's a lot of nutrition. There's a lot of nutrition left in that fecal material, and it's the same with oysters. You know, there's still a lot of nutrition, so that actually gets used. And interesting that you're here today. That boat is from Horn Point, and we're doing a collaboration with a couple of the researchers over there. And what they're looking at is the bioremediation that goes on in the sediment layers under an oyster farm. So in other words, you know, what we're looking for is nutrient reduction in the water. Oysters do that by taking in the algae that absorb the nutrients. So there's a small piece of nutrient reduction that goes on in the bay. But what also goes on under these floats is, you know, that bio fallout that comes down from the oysters lays on the bottom, and then you get nitrogen-reducing bacteria that live inside of that film. And what the guys at Horn Point are thinking is that will dwarf the amount of nutrient reduction that goes on in the oysters themselves because of the massive amount of animals that are underneath of the oysters absorbing the nutrients.
Now, the folks at Horn Point are also growing oysters by the millions that they plant in the bay.
There's two different, well, yeah, there's several different things that go on at Horn Point. You know, people hear Horn Point, they think it's just the oyster hatchery. There is tons more that goes on there. There's a lot of researchers that are doing lots of different things. The oyster hatchery, while it gets most of the press, is a small aspect of what's done over there. And part of that larger stuff that's being done is what these guys are doing now, is they're kind of slowly driving along and they're taking sediment samples and they're checking the topography of the bottom, because they're going to use that in models to look at how nutrient is reduced. So again, those guys in that boat aren't necessarily working on the same things that the oyster hatchery is.
The oysters you grow here, these are what we call chop tank oysters. Is that what
you call them? Chop tank sweets.
Chop tank sweets.
Yep, that is our brand.
Right. So what's the difference between these oysters and the ones in the wild?
In terms of quality or in terms of where they come from?
Both.
Well, we produce all these oysters ourselves. So we have...
You have a hatchery.
We have a hatchery. So it's an old chicken barn that we converted over, and we kind of use it as our base of operations and our hatchery during the season. And what we do is we essentially have, you know, a captive breeding program. So it's the same as a pig farmer has done for, you know, forever, is we grow these oysters and we find these really great performing individuals as we're going through and harvesting them. Well, we save those guys. We don't send them out. So they're fastest growing, most beautiful oysters. And then we keep those and we breed those oysters. And we've been doing that systematically over, you know, 6 years and picking the best of the best, the fastest of the fastest, the meatiest of the meaty. And then we breed those and produce all of our own oysters in the hatchery. And then we move them out here to the farm.
So how do you breed an oyster?
The short form, we bring them in January, and we...
You buy them from somewhere else.
No. These are our oysters. Again, this goes back to our captive breeding program. Right. I was talking about. So as we're harvesting oysters that we're selling, we keep the beautiful ones, take them, put them in the hatchery in January, and we slowly warm the water up. And what we do is we have an accelerated spring and summer as far as the oysters are concerned. So we bring them in at 40 degrees. We raise the water temperature a degree a day every day and feed them copious amounts of algae because in the wild, oysters spawn in the summertime. We would like them to spawn earlier than that. So that way we get to take advantage of the whole growing season. So right now I've got oysters in the hatchery that we fooled into thinking that it's, you know, the end of May. So within about 2 or 3 weeks, you know, they'll think it's June. And then we'll hold them at those temperatures for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then we start to spawn them. You know, so essentially what happens is bring the oysters in, they start to put on, you know, gonadal material. Males become males, males become males, females become females. They start putting on egg and sperm, and then we will spawn those animals and then set them on shell that we produce and then bring them out into the river.
So...
And Horn Point, the oyster hatchery does essentially the same exact thing, only what we do is then we grow them. We grow single-seed oysters. They grow what's called clustered oysters. It's they take a full-size oyster shell and set 100 oysters on that full-size oyster shell because what that full-size oyster shell provides is protection from the predators that want to eat that oyster when it's dumped on the bottom. We shepherd over our oysters and floats. They don't need that kind of protection. So what we do is we set single seed oysters. So we take our oyster shell and we crush it up ourselves into very fine particles. And then we have the oysters, the microscopic oyster larvae set on those very fine particles. So as the oyster grows, it's just a single oyster.
And the shell grows with it.
The shell grows along with it, yeah. So we'll produce those single seed oysters. They go into upwellers in the boathouse and then into floats. And, you know, that's what we grow them out. And again, what Horn Point will do is they'll set a bunch of oysters on large shell and then just dump them overboard, you know, and then, you know, when they're ready to be harvested 3 years later, you know, the watermen will come in and they'll harvest those bars.
And your oysters grow at a much faster rate.
I mean, they do because they're on the top. They're on the surface of the water, so they get more oxygen, they get more algae. Most of the algae in the water is motile, which means it swims, so it swims towards the light. So that first couple of inches of water contain the vast amount of real healthy microalgae.
This work is labor intensive.
Yeah, we really bust our humps every day. It's not easy. Yeah, it's not just chuck them overboard and then come back in 3 years and pick them up.
What's a day then?
On the average day, what we'll do is we'll come in, depending on if we're harvesting or maintaining the population, because in addition to, you know, harvesting them, we do that twice a week, then we've also had to maintain a population, which means, you know, if they're growing, like I said, we have floats that have, when the oysters are really small, there might be 10,000 oysters in there. As they start to grow, they need to be thinned. So we'll tumble them. So we drag floats up onto the beach. They get loaded into a tumbler, which is that piece of machinery down there. It rotates. The oysters tumble down through the tube. They get washed, and they get sent out, back out. So it's kind of repetitive. And it is labor-intensive work.
So the whole notion of oysters only being certain months of the year is gone now, right?
You know, that goes back to before we had refrigeration. I was just reading an article in Al Street News just yesterday, and it was the brew chef. This is a guy who likes beer, and he's a chef. And you know, here's a guy in today's day and age, and he said in the article that oysters are only available certain months out of the year, which is not true. And that goes back to before there was refrigeration, and it really that was how it was created. You know, it was made for people who couldn't even read, you know, but they could speak. So they said, any month that has an R in it, it's safe to eat oysters. You know. And again, that was before they invented refrigeration, because what would happen is they would put oysters, you know, in rail cars and send them out west. And in the wintertime, when it was cold, that's fine because the oysters remain refrigerated the whole time. But they start doing that same stuff in June and July. The oysters would spoil in the trains. People were getting sick left and right. don't eat oysters when it's warm out because there was no refrigeration. As soon as Mr. Carrier invented the compressor and the refrigerant, now we can eat oysters all year round. And they're just as good. There's really no difference at all. There are some oysters, bottom-grown oysters particularly, Chesapeake Bay bottom-grown oysters particularly, are in worse condition in the summertime because they've spawned and they're down on the bottom of the water where there's very little oxygen and very little food. So they get in poor condition. Now, but that has nothing to do with that old adage. It's completely different. That's newer. But our oysters, by virtue of them being on the top, they always get plenty of oxygen, plenty of food. So even when they spawn in the summertime, they still hold their condition. You know, you'd be hard-pressed to tell the difference between a summer oyster and a winter oyster in my oysters because they're grown on the top. And that's the same for anybody who grows on the top, not just me.
Right. In reading the history of all this, I mean, this was they tried this in a huge way 75 years ago in the 1800s as well. And it just fell apart and died. It didn't work. People couldn't make a living at it. Right?
Yeah.
So what is different now than then?
When I first started selling oysters, growing them is one thing, selling them is completely different. What I quickly found is that the price of Chesapeake oysters was way down here. And the price of, farm-raised New England oysters were way up here. And that had to do with the state and its production of oysters. Because, and I've said this before, I mean, we talked about the fact that the wild harvest is produced in the hatchery at Horn Point, and they take it out on a barge and they dump it on a bar and it sits there for 3 years and then the watermen come and harvest it. Is it a wild harvest? If it started its life in a hatchery at Horn Point, is it a wild harvest? I don't know. But what that's done is it's created, because the state is incurring all the costs in the production, and it's created a low cost, low end product. Because it's state-funded. State tax dollars go to produce these oysters. So it has kept the price of Chesapeake Bay oysters artificially low. So 10 years ago, most guys getting into this business, what they would find is the only thing they could get for their oysters was 15 cents a piece. Because they were competing against this huge state-produced wild fishery. What we came in and said is, we've got a better oyster. It's better than the wild fishery. It's more sustainable. It's more consistent. And it's always going to be there 12 months a year. But you're going to have to pay more for it. And that pay more for it is what allowed us to be successful. We didn't come in and try to compete against that wild harvest. Couldn't do it. It wasn't in the plan. You know, the plan said that we have to produce this high quality, higher priced oyster. And that's why when I said, in the beginning, when you're starting to sell, I would go into a guy's office and tell him I wanted 45 cents a piece for my oyster. They laughed me right out of the office. They said, I could get Chesapeake's for 11 cents. Why would I pay you 45? I said, well, because mine are better. He said, well, they're not that much better. So what then we did was then market. Like, we would go outside of the distributors and market directly to restaurants. We'd market directly to the general population, and just to get our name out there. And then we'd come in through the back door and get into the distributors, because we created the demand. They have to supply the demand.
So you actually created this business almost out of nothing.
Oh, it's been conjured right out of nothing. I mean, and I didn't think it up myself. I mean, there are other, I mean,
you're not the first person to do this.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
I'm just the first person to do it here.
Right.
If you look up in New England, I mean, they've been growing oysters up there forever, and when we first started selling, Wellfleet's farm-raised oysters out of Cape Cod were going for 55 cents, so I said, well, why can't I get, that for my oyster, and again, it was a difficult push, but now, everything's kind of turned. Now it's a lot easier, to get that. And again, I mean, people are calling me on the phone to try to pay me that money for that oyster, which, 6 years ago, they didn't want to pay it. But again, it's just a lot of it's about getting into the market and establishing yourself and creating a demand.
I've been reading and hearing a lot of arguments from watermen and people at DNR and from other people who have been reading the articles about this business. What keeps this, if everything is the way you describe it, and I'm sure it is, what keeps this business from really flourishing, from building all down, up and down these riverways to create a business like this? Why aren't there more?
It's a good question. I mean, is there going to be more? I mean, are there right now, there's 10 times more than there was when I got into the business in Maryland. I think there was one, so now maybe there's 10. Is there going to be 100 businesses in another 10 years? I don't know. It's not an easy living. You know, we've had several people who've come to work for us who have left because it's just too tough. You know, you got to have to enjoy being outside, being in the cold and the wind and the rain and the hot, but then enjoying the good days. You know, there's a lot of other stuff, that, you know, so there's the hard work aspect of it, which, you know, again, weeds out a certain amount of people. And then there's the marketing aspect of it. I mean, you can't just expect to come in, work 9 to 5 and go home all the time. I mean, you've got to get out there on the weekends. You got to go to Baltimore and hit the, you know, the city paper cosmic cocktail party and give away free oysters. And you got to do that aspect of it. You have to do more yourself in order to make more of the money. And there's some farms that just grow and they say, and they have just a truck backs up and they just unload everything to the wholesaler. You know, we don't do that. We don't sell to any wholesalers. We only sell to distributors, you know, which again allows us to keep that, you know, that pound of flesh. We don't have to give it away.
So, a couple things about farm-raised oysters. What's the difference between your oysters, essentially, and the wild oysters that are harvested? These are different breed of oyster?
No, it's the same. It's the same species. It's the same species. And again, in terms of the quality, it goes because we tumble the oyster, we power wash it, we box it when we sell it. But then we also grow on the surface, which gives you a meatier oyster. Since we're a contained operation, we're able to sell you a consistently same oyster over and over and over again. You know, I mean, our ranges don't vary wildly. We also can do it, you know, constantly, and we offer that sustainable aspect of it. And you know, is that to say that a wild oyster grown a quarter mile from our farm is not going to have some of the same qualities of our oyster? No, it will. There are a lot of really good wild bay oysters out there, but there's also a lot of really bad wild bay oysters out there. And if you're a restaurateur and you want to get the same product and give your customers the same thing every week, and every week you don't know where your oyster's coming from, you don't know what you're getting. It could be good, could be bad. I mean, what our customers have come to learn is that, you know, when they get that 100-count box of Chop Tank Sweets every week, it's the same good oyster every week, day in, day out. We back it up. If there's ever a problem, we take care of anybody. So it has a lot to do with service. You know, I mean, and I tell my guys all the time, we're as much as a service industry as a production industry because we're servicing all these customers with the product that they need.
So is this, these oysters, you know how they say there's a difference between, and you can taste the difference and see the difference, mm-hmm. between a farm-raised salmon and a wild salmon?
There's a lot of misconceptions between farm-raised animals and wild animals and whether quality of one is better than the other. And it all comes down to whether you're running a feeding operation or not. A wild salmon swims in the ocean and the rivers and eats 1,000 different things over its lifetime. Gives it that unique salmon flavor. A farm-raised salmon eats essentially cat food.
Right.
You know, so it tastes like cat food. All right. So fin fish, there is a big difference between farm-raised and not farm-raised. Shellfish, completely different animal. This animal eats the same exact thing its wild cousins do. So it's not a feeding operation. So you're essentially getting all the benefits and none of the negatives of a wild animal. And that goes the same for farm-raised clams, mussels, oysters. Any filter-feeding shellfish has the benefits of wild, but none of the negatives of it. I won't eat farm-raised salmon. I won't eat farm-raised shrimp.
Right.
Farm-raised shrimp tastes like cat food to me.
Exactly.
Wild shrimp is phenomenal. It's the only stuff I'll eat. But again, wild shellfish is completely different. It's like it's the greatest thing that's ever hit the food world.
So, when you why would you say that?
They're available at Whole Foods in the Mid-Atlantic.
So I'm curious when you look at the future of this. I mean, I one of the arguments people make about the bay and Horn Point and the watermen replenishing the oysters in the bay is if we want to build the bay back, one of the things is to, we'll never be back to the semblance of the 1700s or early 1800s in the bay.
Some semblance of it.
But to get back to that place. So, I mean, how does, do you think this and the work you do fit into that, or do they at all fit together?
What we're doing is we're producing food with a very small side benefit of cleaning the water. Because,
right.
Again, I've got 8 million oysters. That's a drop in the bucket. And I think the restoration work that's being done by Horn Point, by various entities, is phenomenal. And I think if you want to get the oysters back in the bay, that's what you have to do. You have to do it on the scale that they do it. They kill more oysters than we produce. They just, their numbers far out, overshadow us.
You mean kill in terms of when they're raising the oysters, more oysters
die. Than we produce all year. Right, their numbers are through the ceiling, and you need those numbers if you're going to do restoration, not harvest, right? So let's say those oysters are all, let's take all those oysters that are produced in Horn Point, let's put them on the bay bottom, let's build these big, beautiful oyster reefs, and let's keep them off limits to harvest. Right? I mean, this is a keystone species that it's at a fraction of its populations, you know, 100 years ago. But yet we're still going out and we're still harvesting them. I mean, what other animal could you say that we would do that to? I mean, we stopped doing that with the rockfish. They put a moratorium on rockfish when they were at a fraction of their initial populations. But we're still doing it with oysters.
That's why they're trying to get watermen to the argument. We had that discussion with watermen about their reluctance to, but the argument for them to come and do this, to raise oysters. But that's a different job.
It's like coming to you and saying, all right, we don't want you to do radio anymore. You need to now go plant soybeans because we're taking your job away.
Right.
Are you capable of going and planting soybeans? This is something you want to do. I mean, if somebody takes your livelihood, that happens every day. People lose their livelihoods every day. And, you know, are they supported in other ways because they lost their livelihood? No. You pick yourself up by your bootstraps and you find something to do. You know, I've lost my livelihood several times.
Me too.
I've moved on. You know, I found something else to do. It's a real touchy subject, obviously. You know, but again, in what other industry are we willing to, you know, prop up? You know, because people have lost their way of living. You know, it's tough. I know when I've lost my jobs, I didn't like it. They're given an alternative. Are they going to take that alternative? I don't know. I don't know.
What I understood, though, was that the process of you or anybody else doing this was usually onerous to get this started, with the hoops you had to run through to get this going.
And the state really needs to streamline it somehow to make it easier for people. Because, again, it's not the capital costs involved in getting into it. I would venture to guess the typical crab potter who's got to go out and buy a 40-foot boat and all the crab pots, it's a comparable amount of money to get started into the business. But what is the real difficult task is the lead time, is, you know, between when you finally get oysters in the water and when you can start to, you know, live off of that product. You know, it's a long time.
So is it like other farming you had to do alone to spend your first 3 or 4 years getting this going before you could even begin to sell?
No, we didn't have to do loans because, I mean, this is a private company. It's owned by a husband and wife who, you know, had some capital and they wanted to make an investment in a small business. And they had an interest in this type of business. And I met the husband and wife while I was growing fish in New England, you know, because they were there looking at the fish farm as a possibility for doing that as a small business. And we got to talk, and we came to the conclusion that this was a business that we could open, start, and make, you know, a living at, and make a viable business out of it. So, you know, we had some costs incurred, but again, not that great.
To me, this is really interesting. Because I had no. Until I started reading about it, I did. I must say, I had you interview watermen first. You read it, and you do all these shows and stories about farm fisheries. Mm. You know, and so you get a very jaundiced view when you start.
Well, yeah.
You know,
some of them are not. You know, they're not operated correctly. I wouldn't say. I haven't heard too much in the way of shellfish farms because, again, it's not a feeding operation. You know what I mean? It's not even like chicken farming or pig farming. You know, it's different. Yeah, again, it's more like cows. You put them out in the pasture and they just eat grass.
Right. Like if you have a free range, it's just they're out there. They do what they do.
Free range oysters. You know, they're like free range chickens. That's why I get to charge more for them at Whole Foods, because they're free range oysters. But it is, and you know, and most of the environmental organizations, the subscription to National Geographic, and they did a story on fisheries. Mm-hmm. and how, you know, how in jeopardy all of our fisheries was. And at the end of the magazine, they gave a list of the top 10, you know, food that should be eaten, seafood that should be eaten.
Right.
And then, like, around number two was farm-raised shellfish. It may even be number one, I don't remember. Because, again, it really has all the benefits and none of the drawbacks. I mean, it's really beneficial – you know, let alone being harmless.
What do you think, as somebody just knows oysters, what do you think of the argument about introducing Asian oysters into this bay?
I didn't think it was a good idea. I mean, who's to say it would have done any better? You know, I read some of the studies, and it didn't look to me like that animal is going to do any better than our animals that are here. You know, it has a lot to do with loss of habitat. The habitat's not there anymore. And until they're ready to rebuild that habitat, meaning, you know, three-dimensional hard surface in the bay, you know, it's good. You know, I don't think any animal would have flourished.
Yeah.
You know, so now you're going to bring in the possibility of other bad things with an animal that's got no guarantee of being successful. I mean, we've got a lot of successful introductions in this country. Tomatoes, you know, a wonderful introduction. You know, but again, from my perspective, you know, the discussion was that our native oysters, C. virginica, were dying in the bay. My oysters are not dying. If my oysters were dying, I wouldn't be able to make a living. You know, so if my oysters are surviving because we're providing the habitat for the animals to live, who's to say that, you know, I mean, this is not a special oyster.
Well, going back to what we said earlier, I mean, so I know that this is your business, so this may be a hard one to answer. Maybe there is no answer to it. What's the downside here? I mean, in terms of this business and the, I want to say the land, the water, and making this grow?
I don't think there's a downside. You know, I mean, some of the arguments are, you know, that we're taking up space in the water, so people can't do whatever they wanted to in this particular little postage stamp size water. But we've got so much water. There's enough room, you know, for the people to operate these operations. I really don't see a downside to it.
Could you expand this beyond this?
Could. But again, I mean, a lot of it is sales, and it's, you know, it's making the maximum use of your existing space. You know, the more I expand, the larger it gets, the more people I've got to add, you know, in order to do it. So, like, we have a goal of 1 million oysters a year. That's what to sell. You know, we're hitting those numbers, you know. Do we expand, you know, beyond that to get beyond that? We could, you know. Do we have to? No. You know, if the owners who own it decide they want to, you know, make some expansion, we've looked at other options. We might do it somewhere else, not necessarily here. I mean, who knows? Who knows what the future brings? But again, we're still waiting to hit that particular plateau where we can consistently sell 1 million oysters a year without any, you know, without any backlog in production.
No danger of disease?
I don't believe so. I mean, we had very little mortality in these animals up until probably the past year, which is that pile there. That's the probably the only growing oyster shell midden on the eastern shore. And not sure exactly why we lost oysters. We had a really bad icing last winter, so our ice probably went 6 inches deep. So a lot of our oysters froze, and then we had a lot of heat, a lot of really hot water last summer. So there was a lot of mortality up and down the whole East Coast. I had a grower in here from Maine 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he told me he lost a huge amount of his crop last summer because of heat stress. So whether it was heat stress, ice-induced disease, I don't know. You can't do anything about it. You know, you can manage around disease, try to harvest your oysters earlier, put more oysters in, but knowing why something is dead is not going to bring it back. I mean, we've had the animals tested on several occasions, and sometimes they come back with disease, sometimes they don't. Either way, they're always healthy and delicious. That's the bottom line.
You listen to On Delmarva on Public Radio Delmarva, and don't go away, because we'll be right back with oyster farmer Kevin McLaren of the Chop Tank Oyster Company. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's New E-Zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Welcome back to On Delmarva. This week, we're joined by Kevin McLaren for a tour of the Chop Tank Oyster Company, one of the first oyster farms in Maryland. The natural cycle of an oyster to grow in a natural surrounding is what amount of time and how fast is it for you?
We can get an oyster to market size in one growing season. Our growing season starts in mid-April and ends in mid-November. So if I can have an animal, like let's say I put 1 million oysters in the water in April 15th, and by the time we hit November 15th, if everything's perfect, about 30% of those animals are big enough to sell. Because not all oysters grow equally. They don't all grow with the same rate. So you'll have some bigger ones and some smaller ones. So, there are some people who say they can get all their oysters to market in 12 or in one growing season. You know, maybe if you're in, at the equator. For us, it's just not feasible, if you're selling. We sell large oysters. We've kind of specialized in that, not by design, but by, we were asking for a particular price for our oysters, and we created the demand and just said, okay, well, we're going to give you that money, but we want a nice big oyster for it. You know what I mean? So we kind of evolved into a producer of large oysters.
So if you, as you said, if you have 3 million oysters out here in the water, any given moment, maybe 900,000 you can sell.
Yeah, in a good season. Yeah. But we generally do not put down 3 million a year. We have in the past, and last year I put down about 2 million. But generally speaking, my plan is always to put down between 1.3 and 1.5 million. I can kill 500,000 and I still got 1 million to sell after a couple of years. You know what I mean? So you're essentially building in a larger amount than you need.
Right.
So based on that ever-growing shell midden on my beach, last year we put down 2. This year we might put down 3. Just see what happens. The problem becomes is you get bottlenecks in your system. You're running an operation with 4 people and with 2 upwellers, and now all of a sudden you're doubling your work. So we add some summer help to help us get through it, but we still have some physical bottlenecks in machinery, and like we only have 2 upwellers that we can grow.
Just talking what upweller is.
It's essentially a floating barge with false bottom holding units that we put the oysters in. There's a pump it's a high volume, low head pump. It essentially looks like a boat propeller and it moves massive amounts of water, but it doesn't pump it high, which is head. It gets into a kind of technical thing, but it just moves large volumes of water across the oyster. So rather than the oyster having to pump large amounts of water into it, we move lots of water across a very large number of oysters.
If the majority of oysters we eat, 90% I read, of the oysters that we consume on the planet are farm-raised, we seem to have a difficult time to get to that point here in Maryland to make this industry to that point in a place that is the home of oysters.
And again, it goes back to, the history of oysters in Maryland, the state's involvement in the production of oysters, and the fact that it was kept a public fishery, whereas in most other states, that had been abandoned a long time ago. So it had given time for an industry to develop. If people can make money on it, they'll do it. Time and time again, history has proven if people can make money, they're going to do it. But if they can't make money, they're not going to do it. Nobody's going to sit out here and beat their heads against an oyster float for 5 years and not make any money. And again, a lot of it goes back to the public fishery and to the market price of wild oysters versus farm-raised oysters. I sell very few oysters here on the Eastern Shore. Very few restaurants buy my oysters. 95% of everything that we sell goes over to the Western Shore, where you have restaurants and chefs and owners that are more accustomed to the prices of farm-raised oysters and the quality of farm-raised oysters and what they're used to paying for. Because a lot of them, they're fairly well-traveled. They've been other places and they've developed this attitude and expectation of quality and paying for the quality. Whereas here on the shore, you get your oysters in a bushel basket, really dirty, throw away a third of them, but it's only $22 for the bushel. We don't even sell by the bushel. How many oysters are in a bushel basket? I don't know. depends on the size of the oysters. It would depend on a daily basis, you know. So we don't deal in bushels. Most seafood guys don't deal in bushels. Crab guys don't deal in bushels. You know, people who buy it on the side of the road buy bushels, but you know, the buyers buy pounds.
There was a time when they were doing this farming, they were doing it on the beds in the bay. But that doesn't work. Or does it work?
You know, it can work. There's no reason you can't do it on the beds. I still think you have to afford your oysters a measure of protection. We sell seed oysters and floats to waterfront property owners. This is a story. It's true. It happened. And there was a guy up in Talbot County, next county over. He had a couple of bucks. He had a nice waterfront dock, you know, multi-slips. And he didn't even eat oysters, but he wanted oysters growing around his dock. And I had a group of clustered oysters. They were oysters that were, you know, several of them set on the same shell, and I was looking to sell them off. So I sold him, I think, about 200,000 oysters that were all between 3/4 of an inch and 1/2 inch, maybe some an inch. And I went down myself and dumped all the oysters around his pilings, under his dock, everywhere. No floats, no bags, nothing. And I called him up the following summer. And I also sold him two floats with oysters in the floats. I called him up the following summer and I said, hey, you know, you're ready to get some more oysters this year? And he said, every oyster that you dumped on my around my pier is gone. I said, what are you talking about? He said, they're gone. There's not one left. He said, I tongue up around. He said, there's none there. And I said, I got to come over. So I went over, a pair of nippers, I was nippering up, nothing. There wasn't a shell, there wasn't an oyster, there was nothing left around his dock. The two floats that were attached to his dock had big, giant, beautiful oysters growing in them. And what had happened is that the Cano's rays came in and ate every oyster was under his dock. Cano's rays. And it's nothing new. I mean, people have been talking about it forever. I mean, they get in here and they really do a number on seed oysters. And that goes back to why Horn Point sets oysters on big pieces of shell, because the cow-nose rays have a much more difficult time eating the small oysters if they're attached to bigger shells. We just threw down small oysters because that's what we produce. And I was astounded to come back and see that there was nothing there. So that goes back to the question, I mean, are you going to be successful if you just lease a bottom and you sprinkle oysters on it? Yeah, you know, I don't think so. I don't think you're going to be successful doing what we do, which is single seed oysters. If you want to do that, you're going to have to use large shell. So now you're going to have to somehow acquire a massive amount of shell, which is it's a very expensive commodity right now. Everybody wants it. You're going to have to transport that shell to a tank where you're going to have to set oysters on it. Then you're going to have to transfer that oyster to a barge to move on to your lease and then dump it on the bottom to maybe harvest half of it. I looked at the numbers, and I don't see anybody making money based on what it costs to produce seed oysters, what it costs to get the shell, and then you have to put that shell down every year. To me, I just don't see it happening. I'm not saying it's impossible,
right?
But from my experience in the industry and what, you know, what the outlay of money is and what you can possibly get back, you know, you're probably going to go out of business.
So you just have to buy shells?
Yeah. I mean, you can't, it's very difficult, right? Everybody's scrambling to get a hold of oyster shells because that is the preferred culch, and culch is the term that they use for the material that you set larval oysters on. You can use other materials, but there's some problems with using other materials.
Why is it so hard to find shells? Because oysters are so rare?
Yeah, no. I mean, where are all the shell going to come from? I mean, one of the new programs that they just started with one of the environmental programs on the Western Shore was collecting shell from restaurants. Because, I mean, typically people shuck an oyster and they throw the shell in the bottom. And the reason why we have such a lack of shells is because for so many years, oysters were harvested from the Chesapeake Bay, put in bushel baskets and shipped to Philadelphia, New York, wherever, and then those shells ended up in the trash. So where we used to have an abundant amount of dead shell, which was material that the little oysters would set on, we now don't have that anymore. So now, you know, you have Horn Point, which is a major consumer of those shells because they're setting oysters on it. And now if you start an industry where if you're going to have guys growing on the bottom, they're going to need the shell as well. And there's a serious shortage of it.
It seems like this governor is trying to push this industry, though. that this is, I mean, that the interviews you would have with them and with the, and some of the watermen is they're really trying to push this industry. They want this industry to grow. They're trying to give permits out, sell permits, whatever they do. Isn't that the case?
I think so. But what the governor wants and what the different departments want and do is completely different. You know, like it or not, administrations come and go, and the organizations are still there. MD is going to be there long after the governor leaves, you know, and they're, you know, he's their boss now. But again, things change, you know. If the MD tells you, if you're going to sit down and you have a spot where you want to grow oysters, they're going to tell you, we're going to require historic samples from that spot to assure that there are low levels of bacteria. So from the minute you say, I want to grow in that spot, they say, okay, and they start to take their samples. Well, they need samples over 18 months to 2 years to ensure that over time that site is a safe place to grow oysters. That's why it takes so long. Does every site need to be tested like that? I don't know. It's their policy. Are wild oysters, I mean, they're kind of harvested from anywhere. They're not held to the same strict water quality requirements that a farm is. You know, so essentially, the whole bay is open to wild harvest, with the exception of the places that are closed.
Right.
If you look at it from a farmer's perspective, the whole bay is closed, with the exception of the few places that will allow you to do it. It's the exact opposite. I can show you a map of the Chesapeake Bay, and it has in yellow and red, you know, restricted areas and, you know, areas that are prohibited from shellfish harvesting, but the vast majority of it is open. But there's no map like that for oyster farmers. You know, it essentially this spot where we're farming at was open to harvesting until the minute that we applied for a permit to do a farm. And then they said, well, you know, we have to now do the testing. You know, is it the MD catching up with years of a different kind of attitude towards shellfishing? Yeah, probably. Yeah. But we're kind of the new kids on the block, so there's new standards that they want to put in place for us. And do I blame them? No. I mean, I don't want to see any bad farm-raised shellfish coming out of the bay because it's going to hurt everybody. You know, the minute somebody, you know, there's a problem, everybody gets hurt. You know what I mean? So they're, from their perspective and from my perspective, they're doing their job. They're just trying to make sure everything is safe.
Give us a lot of time today. I deeply appreciate it, man.
Oh, no problem.
You've been listening to our conversation with Kevin McLaren of the Chop Tank Oyster Company. For more information about oysters in Maryland, both wild and farmed, be sure to read Charles Cohen's article, Betting on the Half Shell, in this month's issue of Urbanite magazine. You'll find the article, as well as pictures of our trip, on our website at www.ondelmarva.org. Up next, On Delmarva correspondent Tom Horton.
Hello, I'm Tom Horton for On Delmarva with a tale of two green homes. In reducing our environmental impact on everything from the local stream to the planet, our homes offer one of the biggest choices we can make as individuals. I have greened two homes now on budgets that differed by several fold. You'd assume the big budget project could push the envelope way further than my current bungalow, and you'd be right, but greener overall? The answer's not so simple. For both places, we chose similar criteria. Number one, energy efficient. This was to save money, to minimize the carbon emissions causing climate change, and to minimize nitrogen, a key bay pollutant. The less energy you use to heat and cool from coal and oil and natural gas, the less carbon and nitrogen you produce. Criteria two, state-of-the-art sewage treatment. This is to reduce nitrogen and also phosphorus, another key bay pollutant. Three, conserve natural resources by selecting building materials that are recycled or renewably produced. Four, minimize lawns and paving by planting low-maintenance native shrubs, trees, and ground covers. This creates wildlife habitat, cuts polluting runoff, absorbs carbon and nitrogen as the trees grow, and requires very little fertilizer. The first home was a new home in the country, affording possibilities like extra-thick insulated walls and super-efficient geothermal heating and cooling, which draws on the constant temperature of the earth from underground pipes. These would have been tough to do in the second home, an existing one in the heart of Salisbury, built in 1947. To the first big-budget home's recyclable steel roof, shiny to reflect the sun's heat, we added solar panels. These were way too expensive to get a payback any time within the next couple decades, but good for the planet. Many days they spin the electric meter backward, and monthly power bills have been as low as $15. We also installed a waterless composting toilet, emitting almost zero nitrogen. Also put a couple other toilets on special septic tanks that leak much less nitrogen than standard septic. The new house was all wood, either recycled from old reclaimed timbers or from forests certified to be managed sustainably and for water quality. Cabinets were wheat board, compressed straw gleaned from wheat fields, linoleum, cork, and bamboo, all renewable, made countertops and floors. The kitchen was tile from a demolished building. We planted more than 100 shrubs and trees, using a commercial tree spade at some expense to plunk down some specimens up to 25 feet high. A front porch featured black locust flooring, which needs no paints or weatherizing chemicals. It was harvested with draft horses to avoid cutting erosion-prone logging roads. The driveways were runoff-absorbing clamshell. The water heaters were tankless, heating water only when using it. The decrepit farmhouse we replaced was offered to local do-it-yourselfers who hauled away tons of material, saving landfill space. So, how do you follow that act when you look for house number two with a budget under $150,000? First, you insulate to the max. Attics, crawl spaces, basement, hundreds of bucks will buy you mountains of insulation. You find a progressive lender who will fold the cost of new thermal windows into your mortgage so you lay out no cash. You partially bypass the aging AC by installing a whole house fan for less than $900. It pulls air through the house all night, exhausting enough heat that even last summer, a very hot one, I often didn't need to use AC until afternoon or at all. Similarly, you bypass the rattly electric clothes dryer in the basement most of the time with a $3 clothesline and a $15 drying rack in the cellar. You put cheap programmable thermostats on the furnace, hot water heater, and air conditioning. And home number two is small, 1,000 square feet compared to around 3,500 in home number one. We had reasons for the size of home number one, but in retrospect, a more limited budget might have meant we'd have easily reduced its size with no real loss of function or comfort. The smaller house has utility bills that average well under $100 a month, and they'll shrink as I replace older appliances. Also, as the trees grow that I planted everywhere to shade the house in summer and to break winter winds. Sewage in town is municipal, beyond my control, and not performing all that well. All I can do is support politicians who support upgrading it. For all that, buying in town is the single greenest choice I have made. I walk everywhere, or bicycle, instead of burning gas and adding to traffic. My next fridge will be small and efficient, as I can shop daily across the street or at the nearby farmer's market. I'm immensely proud of both homes. If you combined the best of one with the small size and walkable location of the other, we'd be onto something. There is greener than that, however. I think of the big new green home begun by Jerry Lindfest, a wealthy trustee of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. He had broken ground and looked at the size of the hole and decided he didn't need a new home at all. Fill it in, he told his architect.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.